We're going to get things started. And I want to make a golf announcement. We had the third annual Legatus Golf Extravaganza, and it was great. Next year, we have enough for 16, correct? It's June 13 to 15. And was having a conversation with the women at our table, and they are interested in setting up a golf event for the women at the same time. So talk to them. They're coordinating as we speak.
At the same time?
Yeah.
Coming with you?
No. Not coming with. That just would not be good. Because Tom Hurley, I will say. Yes, because for us, it's a lot of prayer. Because you know my golf game on. Okay, we're gonna get started tonight. I was gonna read this, and it says Wednesday Mass, 6 p.m. St. John Vianney. We already did that, so I didn't read that. So tonight we have Patrick Nowakowski. He was the editor for the Legatus magazine for years and years. Yep. The author of 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World and has won a bunch of awards for writing. So really, really blessed to have you. So I'll bring you up. You've got 45 minutes. So okay. Go. And John will stand up.
One of the notable things in my bio is, well, I guess two things. Three things. I met John Paul II 5 times, and that was a very formative thing for me. Most of my talks are on John Paul II. I wrote a book called 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World to mark his 100th birthday in 2020. And because of COVID, it kind of was delayed, but finally came out. And so then I had the chance to meet Pope Benedict, tour as a journalist with Pope Benedict. And then I had a chance to actually meet Pope Francis in person. And I made him laugh out loud. So, okay, a little detour before I get into my talk. I was in Rome with the Papal Foundation, and I was planning to run the Rome Marathon. So I'm in Clementine Hall. There are 100 people lined up to meet Pope Benedict, Pope Francis. It's about 6 years ago, five years ago. And I'm about halfway through, and I'm listening to them, "Oh, Holy Father, this and that," and praising him. And Francis is such a humble guy. He doesn't want you to kiss his ring. He just, just be a regular person with him. So I remembered that this is a Friday, that 2 days earlier, the president of the Rome Marathon had presented him with a finisher's medal in the square during his Wednesday audience. And so I knew that he knew what the Rome Marathon was. So when it was my turn, I held his hand with both of my hands, and I just said, "Holy Father, on Sunday, I'm running the Rome Marathon." And I waited a second because his English isn't so good. But when I knew he understood what I said, I the next thing I said was, "Please pray for me." And then Cardinal Worrell from Washington, D.C., who was introducing us, he laughed out loud. And then Pope Francis laughed, and he says, I do. And I've got the whole thing on video, which is super cool. And the funny thing is, I ran my fastest marathon of my life in Rome. So then subsequently, I ran New York in 2018 and 2019 and beat that time. And in October of this year, I'm running the Dublin Marathon in Ireland. So And part of that is not just because my name is Patrick, but since I was 5 years old, one of my bucket list things is to visit the tomb of St. Patrick. So I'm not yet, but soon to be invited to speak at the Shrine of Our Lady of Knock. And I have a talk in Dublin. And then in probably the 30th or the 1st of November, I'll visit the tomb of St. Patrick, which is a check that off the bucket list thing. Got a few of those, but I'm 55, so I thought, I've got to start making those bucket list things happen, because if I don't make an effort, They're just not going to happen by themselves. And I remember being 5 years old and learning about my name and what it meant and who the saint was that I was named after. And I've always wanted to go. So making it happen. So anyway, thank you for the glowing introduction, Tim. And it's great to be here. It's my first time back in speaking to your chapter since 2019. Your chapter has grown substantially since then. I think there were fewer people at that talk, and your traffic has also grown exponentially as well since that time. But let me start into this talk by saying that I'm a journalist. I'm not a scholar. So I will articulate acutely and fastidiously embrace brevity in order to not exasperate my repertoire for undue accolades. So I'll strive for simplicity on this rather tenuous topic. And that's all the poetry I'll give you. So what I'm going to talk about is relativism, in particular moral relativism. But first of all, we have to start with what exactly is relativism and what does it mean? Let's start with something that our late beloved Pope Benedict XVI said in 2005, right before he was elected to the papacy. He said that one of the world's biggest problems is this dictatorship of relativism. I'll go to his quote here. So he said, "We're building a dictatorship of relativism that does not recognize anything as definitive and whose ultimate goal consists solely of one's ego and desires." Literally, thousands of articles have been written on this quote, and dozens of books have also been written. And this is in 2005, so 18 years ago, and he was speaking to the cardinals gathered in Rome to elect a successor to Pope John Paul II. And little did he know, or maybe he did, that he would soon be that successor. So again, he said, "We're building a dictatorship of relativism that does not recognize anything as definitive. Nothing is definitively true, and whose ultimate goal consists solely of one's ego and desires." Now, if you boil that down, what he's saying is that in our modern culture, truth no longer matters. In fact, truth, logic, and reason are completely irrelevant. Why is that? Why is it that truth, logic, and reason are irrelevant to the vast, not the vast majority, but a lot of the influential people in our culture? I believe it's because we've pushed God off the throne and said we're going to take that seat ourselves. We've forgotten that truth is not a thing, but truth is a person. It's Jesus Christ. Well, of course, you good people haven't forgotten those things, and you haven't pushed God off the throne, but the secular culture we live in, our post-Christian Western world, has forgotten God. So what is relativism in moral relativism? Commonly, it's defined as the theory that moral standards vary from one society to another and from one period of history to another. Now, while that's true to an extent, this dictatorship of relativism, it began by saying, you have your truth, I have my truth, but there's no objective truth. Nothing can be known for sure. So, for example, if I believe that abortion is just fine, who are you to tell me that it isn't? I decide what's true for me, you decide what's true for you, and right and wrong are just a matter of opinion. So we have to stop and go, wait, what? What? We each decide what's real? We each decide what's reality and what's true? To me, that sounds like insanity, because we can't each of us define reality and truth. Interestingly, in 1992, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, remember him, he wrote this. And the amazing thing is that, and I'll tell you the quote, that he actually wrote it down. He didn't just say it. Sometimes people say things that are a little crazy, but he actually wrote this in a dissenting piece in 1992. He said, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and the mystery of human life." I'll read that again. "At the heart of liberty
is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and the mystery of human life. That's a bit of a head scratcher. But as a result of Kennedy's statement, we have proponents of critical race theory doubling down and insisting that people with paler skin, me, are less human than people of darker skin because they can define their own reality. Parents are allowed to choose, they allow children to choose their own gender. The woke crowd professes that we don't choose our actions, but that our feelings and our actions actually define who we are. Now I want to quote one of my favorite scholars, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Now, those of you who are my age and older will remember this guy. He said, "You're entitled to your own opinions, but you are not entitled to your own facts. Either something is true or it's false, and there is no gray area." So for things like abortion, either a unique, unrepeatable human being is created at the moment of fertilization, or it's not. Well, science and literally every embryology textbook will tell you that it is, that at the moment of fertilization, a new, unique, unrepeatable human being is created. And that's objectively speaking. So it's just true. So the question becomes, at least with abortion, is innocent human life worth protecting under law, or isn't it? And if it's not, who gets to decide? Who gets to decide which people are disposable and which aren't? There's a really slippery slope there. So if the unborn are disposable, will the elderly soon become disposable? The poor? Because healthcare is getting really expensive. So, and I'm seeing this in my home country of Canada, where I grew up, that, they'll, and even in places like Seattle, where they will offer you assisted suicide rather than healthcare, because it's just cheaper, and that's what you should do, because that's just the right thing to do. And that's becoming part of the culture. The dictatorship of relativism says that there is no objective truth. And you've probably heard this philosophy that we can't really know anything for certain. Have you heard this? And if you've heard this, it's just truly absurd, because if someone says to you, "Well, we can't really know anything for sure," right? Well, you have to ask them, if we can't know anything for sure, then how can you be sure that what you just said is true? It's kind of a, we can't know anything for sure, but I'm sure that we can't know anything for sure. It just doesn't make sense. It's just pure nonsense. But the truth is that objective reality and objective truth do exist. I don't know whose phone this is, but I truly believe that this is a bar of solid gold. I'm truly believing it. I believe that it is with all my heart. And the truth is that no matter how much I believe this is a bar of gold, it's an iPhone, or it's a cell phone, and it belongs to your wonderful chapter director. But I'm going to start the bidding at $500,000. This is a bar of gold. I'm believing it really hard right now. We can't define reality by our beliefs. It's absurd, and it's truly insane. So I'm going to say something really controversial right now. But and you can record this if you want. It'll go viral. But men are men. Women are women. Women can have babies. Men can't. There, I said it. Now, that kind of language is inflammatory out there. People like, I can't think of his first name, Knowles and Matt Walsh and the guys from the Daily Wire, they go to campuses all over the country, and there are massive protests and pickets and it gets crazy because they say the truth. And people cover their ears and they gnash their teeth because they can't handle the truth, to quote Jack Nicholson. But why is that? Why is it that we can't just say, "You have your truth, I have my truth," and to quote Rodney King, "Can't we just get along?" the dictatorship of relativism has moved past that point. That was maybe 10, 15 years ago. But now, you must affirm my truth, and you're not entitled to your truth. The dictatorship of relativism has spoken. You must believe in this new woke religion, or you will be hated, you will be shunned, you will be fired, you will be doxxed, and you will be canceled. You must affirm their truth. And this woke crowd tears down statues in the name of justice. Even statues of Abraham Lincoln, the man who risked his life and gave his life, essentially, to end slavery. They erase history that they deem to be evil without even putting it in the proper context. They judge the past by their own distorted view of the world, and really a world without God, or a world that doesn't know the reality of God and the true nature of God. And sadly, this woke religion and this cancel culture has also invaded the Catholic Church. And you know, you don't have to check the news more than once or twice a year to notice that. John Paul II said that relativism is a leading cause for the lack of evangelization and evangelism and missionary zeal, evangelistic zeal and missionary zeal, that this idea that truth is relative is killing our desire to evangelize. I've been writing a little bit about this, but the newly appointed, not yet cardinal of Lisbon said just a couple of days ago, you may have heard this, that, yeah, we're just not going to, you know, try to convince people at World Youth Day that the Catholic Church is what it is. We're not going to evangelize there. And that's just not going to happen. Well, he's in for a rude awakening, because evangelization will happen at World Youth Day. It just will. One of my clients is a Catholic singer, and he's got this song that is, I'm not a hip hop guy, and this is not in my notes, but it's a hip hop song called Emmanuel Forever that is, it's not yet released. It's going to be released in a couple of weeks, but I've been listening to it, and it's in my heart now. I mean, I listened to this song about a dozen times, and man, and this guy, he's going to sing on the main stage at World Youth Day on August 4th, and I've seen how young people react to him, and it's beyond understanding. It's like the Beatles all over again. And the guy looks like me. He's white. He's got glasses. He's kind of geeky looking. But he gets up there and he sings these songs that touch the hearts of young people, and they're just soaking it up. So evangelism will happen at World Youth Day, no matter what this new cardinal of Lisbon says. John Paul II, getting back to him, he said that some Catholics have taken the freedom to choose what is right and what is false for themselves. But it's not really freedom that they're taking, it's license. They're taking a license with truth. And he addressed this in his encyclical Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. I'll just read you a little bit of what he said. This is just a part of the quote, but I'll read you the whole thing. He said, "This view of freedom, which is really license, leads to a serious distortion of life in society." He said, "If the promotion of the self," Pope Benedict talked about that, it's really self-worship that we're talking about with the dictatorship of relativism. "If this promotion of self is understood in terms of absolute autonomy, people inevitably reach the point of rejecting one another." And we're seeing that now, that if you don't believe my truth, if you don't affirm my truth, I reject you. And you literally don't exist to me. And painfully, my oldest son, who's nearly 20, has fallen into that ideology. He cut off relations with communication with my wife and I about 10 months ago. And he just believes that we won't affirm that truth, in quotes. So we're dead to him. We're praying the novena to St. Joseph, and he will come back. I'm absolutely convinced that he will. But that worldview is so destructive. So John Paul talked about that people reach the point of rejecting one another. Everyone else is considered an enemy from one who has to defend oneself. And he goes on to say, In this way, any reference to common values and to a truth absolutely binding on everyone is lost. This truth, this objective truth, it's lost. And social life ventures into shifting sands of competing relativism? Yeah, complete relativism. Yes, I should read my own writing. And then at that point, John Paul goes on, at that point, everything is negotiable, everything is open to bargaining, even the first of the fundamental rights, the right to life. So you can reason away even the right to life. And I think he was, in a sense, prophetic when he wrote this. So John Paul points to this distorted language of choice. We've heard this, especially through the 80s and 90s, about this the language of pro-choice. Planned Parenthood has started to move away from that language now because, I mean, if you break it down, everybody should be pro-choice. But the thing is that not every choice is a good choice. Yes, God gave us free will, so we have the freedom to choose. But is it the freedom to choose evil or is it the freedom to choose good? Our courts have said that the human person in the womb has no inalienable rights guaranteed by the Constitution. Thanks be to God that changed a year ago after 50 years of Roe v. Wade, and that now at least every state has the right, the ability to protect unborn human life. John Paul goes on to talk about this, he calls it the sinister result of a it's a tough word. Hold on a second. Do it in Polish. Yeah, very good. Nie rozumiem po polsku. John Paul says, the sinister result of relativism, which reigns unopposed, and we're kind of seeing this now, if we don't stand up to it, then this relativism does go unopposed. The right, he puts in quotes, ceases to be such because it's no longer firmly founded on the inviolable dignity of the human person, but it's made subject to the will of the stronger part. So he wrote about John Paul II, if you really boil down all of his writings, he grew up under Nazi, he was a young man when the Nazis rolled into Poland, and then the government was taken over by communism. So he saw both of these ideologies, the far right and the far left, and both of the ideologies rejected the dignity of the human person. If you really boil down John Paul II's teaching, it is the inviolable dignity of each and every human person made in the image and likeness of God. Each unrepeatable human life made for a purpose, made in love and made for love. And that's what he's saying here, that if relativism erases the dignity of the human person. So he says, in this way, democracy, contradicting its own principles, effectively moved toward a form of totalitarianism. And if we don't stand up to this dictatorship of relativism, it will turn into totalitarianism. And you kind of have seen this in each of the political cycles of the last two presidential elections, for sure, the rise in violence that happens in the lead up to the presidential elections. And we'll probably see that next summer, you know, as we move toward November of 2024, more of this politically instigated violence. And, you know, it's not happening now while we have a Democrat in the White House. And honestly, it's not so much partisan, but it's ideological. You know, what is the understanding of human dignity, and where human dignity is opposed, you'll see this violence when it comes time for elections. So that was a diversion. So here we are. We're in the middle of this woke dictatorship of relativism. Now, the second part of my talk, what to do about it. And it's really pretty simple. We have to pray. We have to pray, and we have to pray more. I mentioned my son. I don't often talk about him, but Father Calloway is a very good friend, and he writes very eloquently about St. Joseph and the power of St. Joseph. When I met my wife we met online in January of 2001 and met in person in March. I proposed in May, and we got married the following April. But even before we met in person, we were praying a novena to St. Joseph every night on the phone together for discernment. And so I know that the power of St. Joseph. And so my wife and I are praying for my son, our son, that God will bring good shepherds into his life and that will lead him back to truth and reality. One of the last things I said to him before he left home was always pursue the truth. And I'm not sure that I think that will come back to him at a point in his life where he's able to really hear that. Because he did once say to me that truth doesn't matter, but it does. It does. And I think he'll recognize that. So Jesus said that some demons can only be driven out by prayer and fasting. So we need to be people of prayer and we need to fast. We need to give up things in order for God's grace to be more effective. You know, I had a great conversation with somebody earlier today about what is grace. I love the parable of the rocky soil. What I believe grace is it's God's sending down grace from heaven that will make that rocky soil fertile, right? So if our hearts are not disposed to receive grace, whether it's in the sacraments or through prayer, then we're not going to receive it. But if other people are praying for us, if other people are fasting for us, those demons are being driven out, and pretty soon that rocky soil becomes fertile. And it takes time. I know it takes time. I didn't come back to the church with my whole heart till I was 26, 27 years old. I was separated from the church. And so I know where, and another diversion, but when I worked for Legatus and at the summits, they used to do Q&A with the speakers from the main stage. And one of the questions that was always asked every year is, one of my kids or some of my kids are not in the faith. What do I do? And this is what we do. We pray. We make sacrifices for them. We rally prayer. And that's the only way because, you know, we lay the foundation. My parents laid the foundation for me. My mother knew that I was not living the faith. And she prayed for me. She constantly prayed for me. And then one day I got fired from the job and I couldn't get back on my feet. I was 26, 27 years old and I was miserable. But I lived close to a church, so I started going to daily mass and started going to confession. And then I met some Catholic friends and they were really alive in their faith. And I started hanging out with them and started to realize that all that stuff my parents talked about, it was true. And I recognized that I had to make a decision of what to do with that. I had the choice to either reject it and go stubbornly on my own way or kind of dig into this a little bit and see what it meant. So I gave God a chance. My heart was opened to the reality of God. And I never in my life thought I would be speaking to thousands of people a year about Catholicism and faith and being able to just go off my notes and talk about things that have happened in my life because believe it or not, I was a shy kid. but look what God did, you know, amazing things have happened in my life because I said yes to what God wanted. So pray fast and pray some more. John Paul II said this at World Youth Day in Denver in 1993. Only in Christ can men and women find answers to the ultimate questions that trouble them. And everybody has to struggle with those ultimate questions. Who is God? Who am I? Who are we as human beings? And why are we the way we are? He goes on, he says, only in Christ can they fully understand their dignity as persons created and loved by God. And, you know, you remember World Youth Day in 1993, all the media was saying, nobody's going to come and see this old pope coming to Denver. Like, they must be crazy. And they thought it was going to be an ultimate disaster. But a million people showed up in Cherry Creek Park in 1993 to see this old pope. And, you know, it's funny because he came to the United States in 1979. He came in 1987. He had a rock star welcome. I mean, thousands of people. Like, A quarter of a million people went to a field in Iowa to see John Paul II. So to think that in 1993, World Youth Day in Denver is going to be a flop? No, they have a selective memory. So anyway, moving on. Prayer. Wrong way, that way. Sacraments. We need to live our lives in accordance with our faith and strive for personal holiness by embracing the sacraments, by particularly the Eucharist and confession. If you can get to daily Mass, Tom Monahan says this all the time, that when he made a commitment to go to daily Mass, despite leading a multi-billion dollar company, it was a game changer for him. And I think it was, oh gosh, George Steinbrenner, or no, it wasn't George Steinbrenner. It was some guy in a baseball team in maybe the Yankees or something, because Tom owned the Detroit Tigers and won the World Series and some, but another really busy guy, famous that I can't think of, was going to daily Mass. And Tom found out about that, and he said, well, if he can go to daily Mass, I can go to daily Mass. And then he built a chapel in his office building and got a priest and had daily Mass just, 10 steps from his office, because he could do that. But he always says that when he made the commitment to go to daily Mass, it was a game changer. So if you absolutely can't, then, God understands. But the more often that we go to confession, the more often that we receive Holy Communion, the more our lives will be changed, because ultimately the only person we can change is ourselves. The only way we can change other people is through how we treat them, how we speak to them, how we live our lives, and how much we pray and beg God's grace and God's mercy for them. That's the only way we can change other people. Humility. I call humility the necessary virtue, because, we'll all approach St. Peter and Heaven's Gate, and it, without humility, we're just not getting in. It's just that simple. If we are proud, we're not getting in. If we're humble, we've got a shot. So humility. Embrace humility. Tell the Lord, and I do this with my own son, my own children, Lord, I can't fix this, but you can. If we surrender to him and allow him to use us as his instrument. I'm writing a book now on Mother Teresa and John Paul II and their work together, their collaboration, and also how, it's interesting how throughout the course of history, God brings together great saints together at the same time who know each other, who collaborate together. And in our day, we had John Paul II and Mother Teresa and so many more, but those two in particular. And Mother Teresa said this, my favorite Mother Teresa quote. She said, I'm a small pencil in the hand of God, writing a love letter to the world. Now, you could write a book on that sentence, but she understood that it wasn't Mother Teresa who was doing the great work. She just abandoned herself to Jesus every single day, every single moment, and said, Lord, use me up. I'm this stubby pencil. When you're done, just throw me away. God wasn't going to do that, but that was her disposition. It was like, I'm just God's instrument. I'm letting him move me, and I'm speaking love to the world. And that showed so much humility for this extraordinary saint. So we need to be that pencil and allow God to move us and use us for whatever he wants us to do. And miracles will happen. My main job is running a crisis pregnancy center. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that I rally people to prayer for our clients. And when I do, when I remember that I need to ask people to pray for these women, we see miracles. We see women who are on the abortion table and walk out, who change their mind. And it doesn't happen every time. We have some women who come in and find out we don't do abortions and they walk out of our clinic. But we always pray for them, and we don't know how their journey will end, right? So we just need to be open to God using us for what he wants us to do. Lastly, we need to live the faith. So the Roman Empire was very decadent, maybe not even as decadent as ours, don't know, but it was very decadent. And the early Christians, Catholics, changed the world by living differently. In particular, they acted differently. They truly loved one another. I had a long conversation this morning with one of my former writers at U Magazine, at Legatus Magazine. And we were talking about our children, and one of the things that I told her is that I've got three teenagers. And one thing that I've learned is that once you have teenagers, you kind of have to transition from being the drill sergeant to being the coach. And I learned that a little late because I'm German-Polish. Yes, thick skin, thick head. This is one of the lessons that I like to tell people who have teenagers, that you can't tell them what to do, but you can coach them, you can lead them, you can suggest. And one of the things that I've learned more recently is that in my tone of voice, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it, with my teenagers, it has to be a little more soft. It can't be, when I'm disappointed, letting them know I'm disappointed, yes, but with love. You know, that was not a good choice you made, but, you know, I still love you. And making sure that my tone of voice is conveying what I mean. And so I'm working on that. And I think we need to be other-centered is my point here. And conveying our love to people is really important, so that they don't feel separated from us. And that especially is true in our own home. So I've been married 21 years. I'm still working on this with my wife, but things are better because I'm learning that my tone and my demeanor, particularly towards my wife, is critical. It's critical. It sets the tone in the home as well. So back to the Roman Empire. So they became very other-centered. They sacrificed their time, talent, and treasure, even for complete strangers. I remember hearing stories of Romans having babies who were not perfect. So they wouldn't kill them, but they would kind of set them outside the town and let them die. And Christians would scoop up those babies and take them into their community and their homes and raise them to be Christians. And the Romans could not understand why these people did that. I mean, this is a child that's not going to grow up to be anything. And they changed the world by how they treated people. And we really need to do the same. How many people have seen The Passion of the Christ? Everybody, yes. So there are a couple of scenes that really resonated with me. One of them, and when you watch it again, you might notice this. When Pilate is speaking to Jesus, Pilate starts speaking to Jesus in Aramaic, and Jesus answers him in Latin. And the guy who played Pilate was like, oh, okay, here we are. And he answered Jesus in Latin. So love that scene. Then it goes on to Pilate asking Jesus, quid est veritas? What is truth? And that's really the subject here. What is truth? And that really resonated with Pilate. He ruminated on that, and he went back to Claudia, his wife, and he says to her, when you hear the truth, do you recognize it? And she said, yes, of course. And he said, I do not. And therein lies where we are as a culture. When you hear the truth, do you recognize it? And if you are close to Jesus, and of course, in a sense, in the movie, it really shows Claudia's love for Mary and Mary Magdalene and her empathy for Jesus. She had a dream, of course, that have nothing to do with this Galilean. Pilate felt trapped that he had to do what he had to do. But really, the point is that if we stay close to Jesus, we won't be easily fooled by the culture we live in. And you'll be much better recognizing the truth, because Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He didn't say, I am one way or I'm a way. He said, he is the way. And Jesus is the truth with a capital T. And the more we know that, the more we live that, the more we'll be able to get through this culture and make a difference. Thank you very much. Happy to take questions. Yes.
Patrick, where did your son go to school?
We homeschooled. Homeschooled him through grade 12, and then he took my oldest son. Yeah, and interesting that I think I'm bringing this up because my Legatus magazine writer and I talked about this quite a lot this morning. And so it's been on my mind. He felt very judged by some his Catholic peers who were also homeschooled, who looked at him and thought, we're better than you, and did not treat him with love or respect. And that and a lot of other things, it's a long story, but that we did homeschool him through. He finished high school when he was about 16 and a half, and then he took some college classes and ended up moving out when he was 18 and a half, 19. Yeah. Anyone else? John Paul II questions.
What was your longest interaction with him?
Oh, I wish I had the picture up here. So I met John Paul II kind of as it was kind of a God thing. I moved to the United States when I was 27, turned 28, working for a magazine, a Catholic magazine in Southern California, and then got a job with the Marians of the Immaculate Conception in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. They have the National Shrine of Divine Mercy. They published the Divine Mercy materials, and mentioned Father Calloway. I met him when he was 21 years old, and Brother Don from Ohio. And so started working for the Marians and in 1996. And Christmas of 1996, the Marians had an employee Christmas party and a raffle, and the grand prize was a trip for two to Cancun. The CFO pulled the grand prize and just happened to be my name and my ticket. I think I only spent $5 and won the grand prize. Well, I was at a point where I just really, really pumped about my faith. So I called the travel agent and I said, I don't want to go to Cancun. I want to go to Rome. Can I switch my ticket? They said yes. And my boss, who was one of the Marian brothers, said, well, you're going to Rome. You might as well stay at our house there. And would you like to meet the Pope? And that was like, yeah, I like that idea. Yes, please. So this is the beginning of 1997. I'm making these plans. And the Marians were commissioned by John Paul II to lead the re-evangelization of Eastern Europe. This is about 6 years after Ukraine became free. Berlin Wall fell in 1989, so it's about 7 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the Marians had priests and brothers behind the Iron Curtain throughout the Soviet era. So the Marians came up with this idea. I was the assistant editor of Marian Helper magazine, and it's primarily their fundraising vehicle and their Divine Mercy spreading vehicle for North America. At the time I worked for them, it went to 250,000 people throughout Canada and the United States, and they also published it in Polish as well. So they had this idea, well, Patrick's going to Rome, and he's a good writer, so let's send him to Eastern Europe, too. So went to Rome, met John Paul II. Interestingly, I recently put this together, that I came to the United States February 1st of 1996. 20 months later to the date, to that day exactly, I stood beside John Paul II, and I had about 60 seconds to stand there and show him my work. I was the webmaster of Marian.org, their main website. And so I'm showing him my work, pages about his encyclical on Divine Mercy, on She Was Then Blessed Faustina,
And I'm explaining my work to him. He said, thank you, put a rosary in my hand and moved on to the next person. But I also had mass in his private chapel. And one of the most, I love telling this story because my brother was with me and he was also invited to come and meet the Pope as well. And I'll never forget seeing John Paul II for the first time that day. I came around the corner and he was at his kneeler in his private chapel in the papal apartments, and my heart literally jumped in my chest. It was only twice in my life have I had a physical reaction to seeing someone. That was the first time. The second time was when I saw my wife walking down the aisle on our wedding day. It was the same reaction. So had the private mass, and then I went to Eastern Europe after that, and Poland, Ukraine, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and wrote a bunch of stories over the course of a year and raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for their work in Eastern Europe. So the Marians, again, put their heads together and said, this kid's got something. Let's send him back again. So I went back in 98, 99, 2000, kept meeting John Paul II and then going to Eastern Europe and writing stories. And then I met my wife and I had to say goodbye to the Marians and move on to my next job, which was working for Tom Monahan's Ave Maria Law School and then Legatus. And now I'm here. So that's my whole life. You guys know everything about me now. Anything else?
Any other questions?
Yes.
Can you comment a little bit on what's going on in Canada? They seem to be ahead of us there.
Oh. Yes. I mean, culturally?
What's going on in Canada?
Oh, gosh. Forest fires. Smoke. gosh, not only that. It's Canada is almost unrecognizable to me now. All of my siblings, my father since passed away, but all of my siblings, all my family lives in Canada. And they say the same thing, that this isn't the country that we grew up in. They're trying to outdo Europe, I think. And there's just so much I could say, but it's and the church is suffering in Canada too. You know, there are so many empty churches. Vibrant Catholicism is a rare thing, but there are pockets of very vibrant Catholicism in Canada, and that's encouraging. But it's a shadow of what it used to be. So the most tragic, and there are a lot of tragic things, but their embrace of what they call MAID, medical assistance in dying. They use these lovely words to describe murder. You know, I don't remember the story exactly, but it was a person who was in the military in Canada and they had a disability and it wasn't anything serious. And the government health system offered them MAID rather than medical assistance. And that's just becoming all too common. I hear stories, the same thing in Oregon and Washington State where assisted suicide is kind of taking root and taking off. But Canada seems to be wanting to outdo the rest of the world in killing its own citizens. Not only the unborn, but anybody who desires it. There are a lot of places in Europe where even young people can choose to end their own lives for whatever reason they want. Yes?
The Eucharistic revival.
Yes.
Minneapolis a year from now.
Yes.
How will the media cover that?
I think the mainstream media is going to be very perplexed by it. They're not really touching it right now, but they're going to be forced to cover it because it's going to be a major thing. It will all depend on, first of all, the outlet, and it will depend on how well versed the reporters are in, and I really think the USCCB is, I know some of the people that they've hired to lead this Eucharistic revival, lay people, who are really good lay people, young lay people who are passionate about the faith. People that came out of the focus groups and focus movement are leading this. So I believe it will be outstanding. I believe it will be a success.
Matter of fact, interestingly, before he was elected Pope, John Paul II came to the United States twice, I believe it's in my book, but and the last time before becoming Pope, he came in 1976 for an International Eucharistic Congress in Philadelphia, where he hung out with this very unknown Albanian nun called Mother Teresa. So they were friends all the way back. I did read that they met in 1972 in Australia at a Eucharistic Congress, but I'm just working on this for my book, but I haven't been able to verify that yet. But I know that they hung out together in Philadelphia in 1976. So who knows the saints that will hang out in Indianapolis coming up next summer. But I expect it will be very good. I think the media will just, the mainstream media is just going to be perplexed by it. And we'll get a mixed bag. We'll get some good stuff and some that is just, you know, saying they'll probably do like they said for John Paul II in Denver, that nobody's going to want to do this. Like, what are they? But it's a teaching moment. You know, the reality of Jesus in the Eucharist, the true presence is, and the reason that they're doing this revival is because there was a study that said that I think 60% of Catholics, people who call themselves Catholics, don't believe in the true presence. And the bishops, to their credit, they do a lot of things wrong as a body, but they recognize, hey, Houston, we've got a problem. And they're doing something about it, and they're hiring good people to pull this off. So I do expect that it will have some really good success. Yes. I did hear a few of them. I know that he apparently did some exorcisms, and one that was really kind of interesting was in St. Peter's Square after a general audience. Now, miracles while he was alive, I have to rack my brains and try to recall. None are coming to mind, but it doesn't surprise me. One interesting sort of miraculous thing is that in the 1960s, when he was studying in Rome, he went to go visit Padre Pio. And that I did write about in my book. And there are some conflicting stories, but ultimately from what I've been able to conclude is that Padre Pio said, if you become the Pope, you will lead the church into the 21st century, into the new millennium. And I believe that because John Paul II was so focused on the new millennium from the late 80s all the way through the 90s. We had the year of the Holy Spirit, the year of Jesus Christ, the year of God the Father, leading up to the Great Jubilee. And he was doggedly determined to lead the church into the new millennium, and he did it. And I guess is a little prophecy on behalf of Padre Pio. Padre Pio also, John Paul, Karol Wojtyła, before he was Pope, had a friend who was a doctor in Poland prior to his election. So this would have been, Padre Pio died in November of 1968. So it would have been in the late 60s. So Cardinal Wojtyła sent a letter to Padre Pio and said, my friend is going in for surgery. She's a doctor. Please pray for her. And what it came down to was that Padre Pio said, I can't refuse this one. So he prayed for her, and they were wheeling this doctor into surgery, and the doctors in their analysis recognized that she didn't need the surgery. She was already healed. So, and then he wrote a letter back to Padre Pio saying, thanks for that. So one of the points I made here today is that if we pray, expect miracles. I had the great pleasure to interview and become friends with the two people who were healed for Faustina's canonization miracle and beatification miracle. The beatification miracle healing was my coworker on Eden Hill in Stockbridge. She had this something called lymphedema. It was a swelling of her legs. It was incurable, and it was she had one leg amputated, and this is late 80s, I think, 88, 89, when it happened. And One leg was amputated. She went to Poland, still under communism, and they prayed at St. Faustina's tomb, and she was healed instantly. And I remember her husband saying, well, you got the miracle we came for. He just expected it was going to happen. He was certain it was going to happen. She didn't have to have her leg amputated. The second miracle for her canonization was a priest from Baltimore, Father Ron Pytel. He was the rector of the Diocesan Shrine of Divine Mercy. And when his miracle was approved, of course, I was working for the Marians at the time, so I called him, and we interviewed him and wrote stories about him. And pretty soon, he was calling me just out of the blue, just to chat. And he had a heart ailment where he described it like this, that if you take a balloon, you blow it up, that balloon can never go back to the way it was. And he had a part of his heart that was stretched that way. So he had to take medication. I think it was on St. Faustina's feast day that he was prayed over with one of her relics. And it was in the evening, and he went back to his room and realized that he forgot his medication. He took his medication and had a bad reaction to it. So he went to his doctor the next morning, and the doctor ran some tests, and they said, you don't need your medication anymore because your heart's normal. And he said, well, my heart's never been normal. Well, it's normal now. Come back in 6 months and see us. Stop taking those drugs. And the interesting thing, too, was that he was seeing some of the best cardiologists in the country, and they documented all of his ailments, and none of them could understand how, because it just doesn't happen. So if we pray for miracles, expect miracles. Our God has always been a God of miracles, and he's not going to change. So pray and expect. So anything else? It's 9 o'clock. happy to I'm not in a hurry to go anywhere. So if you guys want to pick up a copy of my book, happy to answer questions and chat. Thank you.